Hey, New York City and the rest of the world, how are you today? It's time for Insight on PRN.FM, Progressive Radio Network. The show is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. Beautiful day in New York City. Got a few hurricanes, tropical storms around the world. Russia is saying that they can't bring, they're going to not permit us to bring certain goods into their country. I don't know how we're going to survive that. Jeez. And how are other countries going to survive not selling goods to Russia? Jeez, I guess we're really going to suffer, Putin. So, you know, Chris Martin's been in the news for the most popular part of his life lately, separation of Gwyneth Paltrow, actress Gwyneth Paltrow. And that was up until last night, because last night he was in New York City, and he's here today, but he was here for a different reason. And in a few seconds, you're going to hear about why he was here. First, I just want to give you a little bit of background. They announced a secret concert that Chris was going to be doing about a week ago, and you could only win tickets to this very, very coveted concert, an acoustic performance by the frontman of Coldplay, Chris Martin. And here's a little bit of what it sounded like to be there in New York City in a very small, intimate club last night.
Everybody doing okay?
In front of me.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for shouting that so loud and so beautifully. Okay, we'll just play some songs, some Coldplay songs, if that's okay. And then you can go about your business.
All right.
Oh my God. I can't.
Is everybody in?
It's just me, I'm afraid. Did you just say blow me? What did you say? Oh, see, I'm so sorry. Please.
So that's a bit about what it sounded like last night when he came on stage. And it was really an interesting build-up. We're going to talk about this throughout the show. It was not just like, okay, you have your tickets, you walk up to the door, you walk in, Chris Martin walks out on stage. No. Part one was you had to win the tickets. So we got the tickets. And a little background is my wife is a die-hard Chris Martin fan. She eats, lives, and breathes Chris Martin, as much as somebody in a music fanatic can. So she told me a few months ago for her birthday, she said that she only wants Chris Martin tickets. So I said, sure. But upon my research, I realized that he wasn't doing any performance. This was before they announced the iHeartRadio concert in Las Vegas, where he's going to be performing with Coldplay. Long story short, got my hands on a pair of tickets, and this is going to be for only about a 200-seat venue last night. So that was part one. Part two was it was undisclosed location. We didn't know where. We didn't know what time. We just knew it was yesterday. So, and if you're in the tri-state area, you know, it doesn't take too long. Depends on where you are. But did you have to take the day off from work, a half day, full day? You know, where was this going to be? How long, et cetera? So there was a lot of mystery involved. And we're going to strip away what exactly took place throughout the show. Because it was really, really unique, exciting night. And, you know, I've been to, I don't know, hundreds of shows in my life. Being in radio for the last 20 years, working in smooth jazz. I've seen every smooth jazz and most of the traditional jazz artists that are alive. And in a rock format, a lot of big names, certainly through the station, and just being a music, avid music fan. So last night going to the show, I was kind of like, you know, it'll be a good show, but there was a lot of hoops to jump through to get there. But for my wife, hey, no problem. I'll do whatever it takes, backflips, whatever I had to do. So, but once I was there, I was kind of like, oh, okay, all right. This is pretty cool. 20 feet away from the stage, 200 people around me, very, very small. But it's today, actually, that I'm really appreciating the show. I don't know why. I guess I really had to absorb it. And there was a lot going on yesterday. Yesterday was just a hectic schedule. And I didn't want to think of myself as being kind of jaded. You don't want to be that jaded person. It's like, come on, I don't want to do that. I just want to get in, see the show, and leave early. It's kind of like the people who go to the games who go late and leave early. But I'm happy to say it was a really, really good show. Being a parent of a 5-year-old and soon to be a 2-year-old this coming Saturday, August 9th, Danica will be turning 2. I have been encountering some situations with my 5-year-old, which made me think of the greater picture of other people in this world that are faced with a very similar scenario. My 5-year-old says to me, So where is your brother Mike? I lost my brother Mike. People who listen to the show Insight historically and or on a semi-regular basis may know that I lost my brother to suicide 20 years ago. So I always want to keep Mike, his uncle, that he never met, never will meet, in the family tree realm conversation, so he just kind of knows who he was, because I think it's unfair and unjust not to include somebody's life. I mean, he was such a great person, full of life and bright, successful, fun, and he was my brother, so he was a big part of me, so why shouldn't he be a big part of my son? So that got me thinking, wow, there's so many people in this world who've lost a father, a sibling, a mother, grandparents, of course, great-grandparents. So how do you have a dialogue with your children about such a horrific, could be horrific, instance? Of course, death is, runs its natural course, hopefully for most people, and the natural order is not thrown out of whack when, for example, my mother and father lost their son 20 years ago. And then I also speak to my son about how his grandfather, my father, Frank Farrell, died. And so the vernacular, the semantics, what words do you use? How far do you go into a story? How much do they need to occupy or satisfy their little brains to say, oh, okay, well, they're not there, they're not here, that's okay, they're good people and I like to hear stories about them. So, you know, it got me thinking more and more about maybe this is something that, you know, as listeners know that I speak to students nationally about overcoming adversity, anti-bullying, drugs and alcohol, mental health, etc. But this is something that, you know, growing into more of a parent role as my kids get older, it's going to be something I'm going to be faced with more and more. And then I started thinking about the different layers. What about a sibling losing a sibling? Maybe a 10-year-old losing possibly a very... this is really, really hard and difficult to think about. But it does happen. I mean, we read this in a paper, maybe bi-weekly, monthly. It happens. It's sad. But what's the proper dialogue? What terms should you use? How much of a story do you actually put out there for someone to know? What is palatable? Clear, concise language? Dumb it down? Do you tell the truth? So I have some of these answers I concocted in my head. I have been telling my son, you know, my brother Mike got sick. I can't tell him that he leapt off a 40-story building to a 5-year-old. When he gets older, when it's appropriate, that'll be the right time. But right now I just said he was sick, and he says, well, what was wrong? I said, well, you know, he just really had an illness and he couldn't get better. It is the truth. Now for my father, I also said, well, he was old. Wasn't that old. He was in his 70s when he died of Alzheimer's. But, you know, he was a great man. You would love him. He would love you so much. I say this to my son. But, you know, I have to watch my language. And this actually even goes true for my pet. I had a dog named Gibby. And Gibby was a legend in my town. Gibby, I'll go into this in depth some other time, but he was a character. This guy had, like, the personality of, like, 5 beer belly drinking men, man. He was just really hysterical. And so he was unfortunately hit in front of our house when I was young. I think I was probably in 5th grade. And he was struck multiple times by cars because a policeman showed up on the scene, didn't want to move him because he didn't want to get bloody, et cetera, et cetera. So, but there are countless really colorful, compelling, funny as hell stories about Gibby, what he did. He used to go in food stores. He used to go on people's porch, steal food. He used to steal, or I used to feed him under the table, like all our scraps. And our family would be like, wow, Mark, you eat a lot of steak. And to my siblings as well. I mean, this guy, they could have made a comic strip about him alone, Gibby. It would have made a good name as well. So, I mean, like, now what do I tell my son? Like, well, I did say he got hit by a car. This is a small example. So I figured, you know, we need to get an expert on the show here at Insight, especially with an international audience on PRN, to find out what exactly is the proper method. Good Grief is an organization in Morristown, New Jersey, that serves hundreds of children and families each year after the death of a mother, father, brother, sister, sibling, you name it. And I'm proud to introduce Joe Primo. He's the CEO of Good Grief. Hey, Joe, how are you? Joe's not there right now. He's probably counseling someone as we speak. And we're trying to get Joe on the phone right now. And bear with us a moment. And I'll tell you that, you know, it's not an easy conversation to have, but it's a, you know, it's a conversation that's pivotal. It's I think you do more harm when you, and we're going to find out from Joe in just a moment, when you don't address the situation or maybe address it in the wrong manner than not addressing it at all. Hey, Joe, how are you, my friend?
Hey, Mark, I'm doing great. How are you?
You just missed the most the best intro of the history of radio, and you weren't on the line.
Oh, that's terrible. What happened?
You were probably very busy.
Yeah.
I was putting you up on a pedestal, Joe.
Oh, that's terrific. Thanks very much for that.
hope you're not afraid of heights.
Oh, it's a long way down. It's a long way down.
So exactly. Long way to get up there as well. So I was talking to our listeners about, you know, I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and the 5-year-old, I lost a brother 20 years ago due to mental illness, and my father, Alzheimer's. And those are just my examples of talking to a 5-year-old and how it made me realize the importance of the dialogue and how much more dialogue there is in the future and how much you actually put on the table.
Yeah.
Semantics, logistics, I'm sorry, the vernacular of what you do. And so when I did some research, of course, your name came up because you've written a great book, What Do We Tell the Children? Talking to Kids About Death and Dying. It came out last year in 2013, got great reviews. You're a chaplain, correct?
Yeah.
And you've designed programs for your organization, Good Grief, which I love the name of because it just makes me think of Charlie Brown.
Yeah, totally.
So let me ask you this. Now, do you remember being a young boy and someone having a conversation with you, your mother or father, about someone who you possibly lost in your family?
Well, not precisely. I am Irish and Sicilian. So,
whoa, that's a lethal mix, my friend.
It really is a dangerous combo, and those two should just not procreate.
You're
but
right.
It seems like they're everywhere. Yeah, so, you know, the Sicilians, my Sicilian grandparents would say, you know, love, hope to see you next time, assuming that I live. So, you know, there was always death on the horizon.
Wow.
And then the Irish didn't really talk about it because they lived forever. Like, they just kept going like Energizer bunnies.
So
but,
true.
You know, it was interesting. My early experiences I wouldn't call it secretive per se, but my grandmother's baby brother died of a heart attack when he was 53. And I wanted to go to the funeral because I knew Uncle Joe, and my grandmother said that we weren't invited. And, you know, my grandmother's very loving, very inclusive, so I was totally surprised. So I asked my dad, well, what's this about? And I was probably 7 or 8. And he says, well, you know, Italians get really emotional and they're kind of hysterical. So I'm imagining, you know, like my grandmother passing out at some sort of wake and things being tossed or, you know, some sort of theatrics. And, you know, that wasn't at all the case. And it was interesting. My grandfather ended up dying about 5 or 6 years ago. And I actually saw for the first time that Sicilian grief. And, you know, people could say that my grandmother was hysterical, but I thought it was amazing. She was very outward in her expression of her grief, and it was on the table. She put it on the table in a way that I don't think most people are accustomed to. And so I think I got swept up, and even in a very inclusive and open family, in this idea that we need to protect the kids. If they see emotion and grief, that's somehow scary and bad. And, you know, Mark, that can be a little bit overwhelming, especially for a child who's lost a parent and the surviving parent is just uncontrollable. And that could feel especially to a young child, like the wheels are coming off the bus. So I think there needs to be a little bit of moderation, but to sweep it under the rug is not helpful.
Well,
these are real learning opportunities.
There's a lot of valid points you pointed out, Joe. And first off, I have to say that addressing the parent issue, I mean, all kids view their parents, I would say most of all, as the Rock of Gibraltar. So it's okay, and I think it's pivotal for them to see that you do suffer, whether it's even getting an injury or hurt. You're not infallible. You make mistakes, and then also that you know you are a person of emotion, within check.
Right.
And I did see something similar to what you mentioned. Actually, I was probably about 30, and I went to a Chinese funeral, and someone was actually physically beating the casket, and I was paralyzed. It was actually my girlfriend's mother at the time, and no one was going up to you know, stop her, to console her, and I just was like, oh my Lord, somebody needs to do something. But she was physically just beating, hammering away with her fist, and that's not what we're here to talk about today. But I mean, you brought that up, and it just, now, if I was a child, I was an adult, and I was taken aback. So if I was a child, I think that would be a little bit traumatic.
Yeah, I think perhaps not having a reference point.
Sure.
And I think that's the real challenge with kids. Obviously, people ask me all the time, how do you talk about kids about death and dying? And, you know, it's not an easy conversation to start, because as adults, we don't talk about this. And so if as adults, we don't have vocabulary and we're uncomfortable and, you know, we've lived our lives without having a dialogue around this, how are we all of a sudden going to open up that conversation with kids in a helpful and healthy mm-hmm. way? And so, you know, it really does start with us, so that we're able to have open and honest conversations around this issue. And I think so much of it also has to do with a value system. And I don't mean that in regards to, here's how you live your life, and when you die, you can go either, because of how you lived, you mm-hmm. go to heaven or hell. Like, that's boiling it down too simply. I mean, if we are open and honest about the fact that we are mortal and biological, and we are going to live and we are going to die, then that also helps, you know, us grow up into adults thinking about what sort of life do we want to live. Being aware of the fact that life does have a stopping point mm-hmm. helps us.
And there's no certainties.
And you know, it helps make life decisions with that sort of awareness.
So how do you begin dialogue? Do you need to have this dialogue before there's a death in a family?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, oftentimes people think that kids don't understand death, and they already have a framework for it. It's everywhere. It's on TV. It's in video games. It's in their shows. It's in the literature. They see it with roadkill. So it's not that they don't have a reference. It's as adults touch upon and facilitate a dialogue around what they already know. So, you know, I think it's starting with, don't assume that they don't have any idea or thoughts or feelings around death and dying. Check in and say, hey, you know, what do you think this means? What do you already know about it? Assess that, and then and see and get an understanding of what their reaction is to it. Is there fear involved? Is it kind of sort of this distant thing? Because depending on where kids are at developmentally, their thought processes around death are going to be very different, right? So that 3-year-old is going to look a lot different than that 8-year-old. That 8-year-old is going to look different than that teenager. So the way in which they're processing what death means, that it's finite, that when people die, they don't come back. And, you know, being in New Jersey, having centers in New Jersey, we have a lot of folks who work in Manhattan, a lot of parents who were business folks and traveled the world or the country. So kids are used to parents being out of the house for a week at a time.
Oh, sure.
And all of a sudden, mom dies, and you know, their ability to realize, well, no, she really isn't coming back. You may be familiar with having a sense of distance and space in your relationship with mom, but she's dead and she's not returning. So I think that's a bit of a process.
But where did she go, Dad?
Well, and that's where a lot of adults run into hiccups. They're not sure what to say. And even if somebody is not religious, they'll oftentimes go to the spiritual. And all of a sudden, mommy's in the sky, mommy's in heaven, or all different sorts of euphemisms get built in. And that's really confusing, because all of a sudden, we're standing in a cemetery, and there's a box, and people are standing around it and crying, and people are saying that mommy's in the box, but wait, I thought mommy was in heaven. So, kids are concrete, literal thinkers. So I feel like the greatest gift that I can ever give a parent is, keep it biological. Death is a biological experience. So start there. If you have religious beliefs, they're not inappropriate, but you got to build up to it. That's, that can't be step number one. That's more like step number ten. Step number one is, what does it look like when we're alive? We breathe. Kids really love it when you do bodily functions. So we burp and we fart and we can call people on the phone and we can text and we can tweet and we sleep and we need to drink water. We need to drink food. All those things are a part of living. Now, what does it mean to be dead? Well, we can no longer, we don't need to eat. We don't need to sleep. We don't burp. We don't fart. All of it, that other stuff. So talk about what it means.
My
for
wife
our body
may challenge
to function.
You on one of the things I may be doing postmortem.
Well, actually, that does happen in the first 24 hours. There's still
it'll still happen for years after I'm gone for me.
Oh wow, that's a gift, Mark.
Yeah, exactly.
keeping it really simple like that and mechanical, because kids can think mechanically like that. And so mommy's asleep. That's never helpful.
Because they would be afraid to go to sleep.
Yeah, exactly. And these things, that, you know, it may seem intuitive to you and I and to people who are listening, but it's not intuitive for everybody. And that's not a reflection on them. I mean, I think that's, again, we don't have the language and vocabulary as a society because we're not talking about this. And especially if you're not doing your prep work and talking about death and life before death actually happens, then all of a sudden you're having that conversation when you're in crises. And when we're in crisis, we don't think clearly and cohesively.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So of course we're going to stumble. And when we do stumble, that doesn't mean that we've broken it or done damage to a child in a way that's irreparable. So to give an example, there's a lot of stigma around suicide. And so a lot of secrecy happens when a parent or perhaps a teenage sibling takes their life, and the younger kids get misinformation. And oftentimes there are secrets. And the challenge with that is
long-term damage.
That child, when they learn what really happened, and if it's 5 years, 10, 20 years down the road, they're going to regrieve because now the narrative has changed, and they have to process the narrative in a new way.
Absolutely.
So what's important is that we're honest. And if we make a mistake, so I've coached parents before who maybe they've gone 6 months, a year, saying dad died of a heart attack when really he killed himself. Bring the kids together. See if they've learned anything, because for all you know, they've picked it up from their friends, from social media, and they're just not telling you because they're protecting you, the other surviving parent, because they think you can't handle it.
Exactly. And they could build up a wall against you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can break down trust really quickly and easily. And you want to have a trusting relationship. And it's the same reason why a kid says, or especially it happens a lot with parental loss, a child may get really clingy with their surviving parent. And, when they say, are you going to die like mommy died too? And if you say, no, I'm not going to die, well, that's actually not comforting. Help that child express what their fears are and to affirm them and to support them, because they know that, yeah, if mom died, so could dad.
Sure,
so you're not being real with me.
Say that I'll be here for, many, many years. Hopefully, you'll be married and have kids. I live a healthy life. I'm careful. And that's why I want you to be healthy and careful and so on.
But if I do die, Aunt Jenny's going to take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a plan in place. And I think what's really hard for parents who have young kids, especially under six, is that they think it's about them. And for those kids who
they think it's about Joe?
They think it's about them, the surviving parent, that the kid is stressed out because they don't want me, Joe, to die. Well, really, that kid just wants to make sure that their routine is not going to be interrupted, that they're still going to have access to their video games and to their friends and to the things that they enjoy. And if you can say, all those things are going to remain in place because Aunt Jenny's going to take care of you, that's actually comforting. And that changes as the child matures and grows up, and then it becomes more about the relationship. And the child would be devastated if I, Joe, die in a way that's a little different than just me, dad, dying. And that's not always easy to for a parent to swallow, because they're forgetting that, you know, kids just want to help, younger kids want to have their basic needs met. That's of real urgency and importance to them, and they're afraid that's going to be disrupted.
Joe Primo is my guest on Insight Today. This is PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. He's the CEO of Good Grief, located in New Jersey, Morristown, New Jersey, and they serve hundreds of children and families each year after the unfortunate death of a mother, father, brother, sister, sibling, etc. He's my guest. And what words, Joe, would you say, some pivotal words that you would steer clear of, and other words that you would want to incorporate in your explanations?
Oh, you know, words are really difficult. That they're perceived and they're heard differently, depending on cultural context.
True.
Depending on the kid.
Age.
You know, age. So, more so than words per se, I would stay away from euphemisms. And an important word to use is dead. Dead. Died. Death. Use the D word. A lot of people dance around the D word, but that is really important to helping build the vocabulary for what's happening. And that goes back to my previous comment about, you know, keep the explanation of death biological. Make sure your explanations are clear. Kids need consistency. So put a consistent routine in place. Be honest. And ultimately, I think if adults ask themselves, you know, what's the end goal? And if the end goal is to be helpful and to assist a child in developing coping skills that are going to serve them through this loss and through, you know, future grief, then, it's really, so just a little background information. I'm of the belief that, you know, these five stages of grief and loss that came up in the 60s from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And professionals, we don't support them. Elizabeth didn't support them before she died. They were being misinterpreted, but they were part of the great awakening of Americans realizing, hey, we got to start talking about death and dying. Yet it's very much a part of the vernacular. And I'm of the school of thought that grief is not, and many others are too, grief is not something that happens in stages, but it's cyclical, it's circular, it moves, you know, it's very, very fluid. And what's important are three basic processes that we need to allow kids to think all of their thoughts, even ones that might be hard to hear, like this might be my, you know, when a kid says, I think it's my fault. Well, what does it mean? Why do you think that this death is your fault? Allow them to feel all of their feelings. I feel angry. I feel numb. I feel relieved. I feel guilty.
Scared.
I feel scared. And by allowing people to think their thoughts and feel their feelings, you know, they are allowed to land in a place where they can continue to go on living and loving. And what's important to realize about that is that's a big commitment. That's a big step, because to go on living and loving is to acknowledge that that those relationships that they're going to continue to invest in could end at any moment also, just like the one they just experienced the ending of. So think one's thoughts, feel one's feelings, and then to go on living and loving. I think that's a really crucial process in how we understand and support a child's grief, so that they can have the coping skills that they need. Because this is probably, you know, they're going to experience other difficult things in their life, whether it be the death of another parent, other loved ones, or just other life events that cause them grief.
Sure. Now, of course, we're not always in control of our emotions. If you're not Irish, I should say. But, you know, sometimes, certainly if you're explaining something to a child, or whether they're 5 years old or 10 or 15 years of age, that you may not be able to predict how you'll act. Sometimes, I mean, I could be in front of an audience of 500 people at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention talking about the loss of my brother 20 years ago, and I could be totally fine 9 times out of 10, and one time I'll be like, oof, you know, you get overwhelmed. But if you bring this to the family setting, we touched on this a little bit before, Joe. I imagine it's okay, obviously, to show your child that you are vulnerable to a certain degree. But then if it becomes habitual, maybe that's something that the child shouldn't see, because they need to know that if their need to go on, maybe their parent needs to understand and be able to be healthy as well and continue their everyday routine.
Yeah. You know, there are stories where kids are living in households where all of a sudden somebody dies and the place turns in, the house turns into a shrine. There are photos everywhere. Or the person dies and the next day all of their clothes and their belongings are completely stripped of the house.
Wow,
and there,
yeah,
there
sure.
are no reminders. And so, you know, I think we need to follow a kid's lead and to understand what their needs are for processing. And, you know, it may vary. There gets to a point where a kid may get to a point a few years later where they don't want to be identified as a grieving kid. They want to feel normal. And normalcy is really, really important. And when emotions come into play, that, you know, especially difficult hard emotions, that can disrupt the routines a little bit. But I think, to your point, Mark, it's really important to be real and to be open with children. I think there comes a point where it can become unhealthy if a child's normalcy is being, you know, severely disrupted, if a parent is unable to get out of bed and take care of the children. So, you know, this is a difficult life experience, and support is absolutely needed for most people.
Sure.
And
go ahead, please.
And at Good Grief, we do peer support because we think that for kids, the most powerful experience that they can have is hearing from their peers who are going through something similar, processing it in the same way, and able to talk about it in a way that reflects where they're at developmentally. So if we normalize the feelings, if we, you know, check in with kids and see what their actual needs are and not assume that what they need is to have the dead person's, you know, reminders of the dead person purged from their home or purged from their lives, because kids like to feel a sense of connection to the person who died. And so if you tell a child, wow, you really, when you do this, that really reminds me of your dad, that tends to be a really comforting and helpful thing to a child.
Interesting, yeah. I see that. My son regurgitates that to me all the time.
Oh, well, that's good. He actually wants to be like you. That's a plus.
And I even say to him, you know what? Grandpa Frank would love to see you do that or X or how well you do X.
Yeah. I mean,
incorporate that.
Here's another important thing that I think that we need to reframe as a society. We have this idea that somebody dies and, you know, boom, it's over. That person, you know, because we can't interact with them, they are vanished from our lives. And that's not true. You know, the relationship that we had with that person, whether it was good, bad, healthy, or unhealthy, we carry that with us mm-hmm. for the rest of our lives. And we can compartmentalize it and put it in a box because it may be painful or difficult for us, but it's still there. So for that kid who, let's say, was 10 years old when their dad died of a heart attack and that dad was a real tough cookie on them, that kid can try to compartmentalize that relationship, but dad's still over that child's shoulder echoing perhaps or whispering, you know, unhelpful or, you know, mean things that dad may have said to that kid, whether it be on the field or about homework or physical appearance. So the relationship carries on, and the same with all the positive stuff, that loving, nurturing dad, to engage that relationship, I think is really, really important. The relationship continues even though the person has died.
I mean, we all are here to do a certain thing in life when we're alive here. And hopefully that's the reason why we create a legacy. Hopefully most of us are fortunate enough to leave an indelible mark, whether it's something we create, tangible or intangible, legislation that we help pass, something of that nature, conversation that we're having now that impacts the way someone lives their life or treats other people. So it would be a shame to just turn off that valve and not have that legacy story, whether it's symbolic figure in life, just to be put away, shove off to the side. So I totally agree with you on that, because there's no reason why. I mean, we talk about historians, great historians. We have days off for dead people. Right?
Not enough, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation. But very quickly, you know what? I and I'm sure you would back me up on this. I'm a big proponent of teaching my children, especially my five-year-old, to be aware, self-aware. Like, if you're happy, great. Obviously, it's obvious. If you're sad, if you're melancholy, hey, what's up? Tell me what's on your mind. Is school okay? You're not happy, blah, blah, blah. So this is part and parcel, and that's a great setup to the day and or the slow building foundation steps of what you're talking about in terms of the biological aspects. And I believe it should go hand in hand and, you know, slowly over time. And this way, the foundation's there when you need it.
Yeah, absolutely. And teaching kids self-awareness skills is crucial, and also the expression of feelings, because there are healthy ways to let out feelings and there are unhealthy ways. Just a quick example, we have at our center something called the Volcano Room. And, you know, it's a padded room with mats, and the kids can just go in and physically let it out, because grief is not just an emotional thing. It's a physical thing, especially for kids. You know, a lot of grieving kids get headaches and belly aches, and they don't feel well because they can't find a way to get that grief out, and they need to let it out physically. So I definitely encourage playing sports and whatnot. But we have the Volcano Room so that kids learn, you know, I can romp around and physically let this out and
release
punch a pillow,
kick
a ball, and that's better than hitting my little sister. That doesn't come with consequences, and I can still feel, by letting it out physically, I can feel good after. So I think finding helpful ways and uniquely working with each child so that they have a unique expression of how to get out feelings is crucial.
Hey, Joe, I can make it over to Morristown in about 45 minutes. Can I have about 20 minutes in your Volcano Room? I need some release.
Yeah, I'll leave a key for you. You can come back whenever you want to hang out.
Hey, lastly, Joe, at what point would you say to parents and or caretakers, siblings who may be taking care of their niece or nephew after the loss of a parent or parents, that when should professional help be intervened?
You know, that is case by case.
Sure.
It depends. We have people enroll in our program, you know, a couple of days after the funeral to a couple of months to a few years because they thought they were doing okay. Then all of a sudden they realized, hey, we haven't been talking about this, and it's coming out in a whole bunch of different ways. So I think it varies, but I think it's hard work it depends on what your support systems are. And so I think it's really important to identify support systems, to find helpful ways and helpful people so that when you tell your story, when you express your grief, you feel good afterwards, not people who are shutting you down or turning it off. And the sad thing is that as a society, especially with young deaths, a mom or dad who's young or child death, we'll be present for those people for 3 months, maybe six. But 8 months afterwards, we're back to our lives, and we're not paying attention to these folks, and we're not providing the support that they need, and we tend not to be available, and we tend to change the subject when they bring it up.
Mm-hmm. And we tend not to look back purposefully.
And we tend not to look back. So I think having lifelong support systems in place is crucial, and building relationships who are going to be there to carry you through it is fundamental.
Great advice, Joe. Now, your book is available everywhere, I imagine. What do we tell the children talking to kids about death and dying? Amazon.
It's a good read.
It's a good read. unbiased opinion right there.
I don't know. Read the Amazon reviews.
There
so
you
far,
go.
We're doing okay.
Exactly. And how do people get in touch with Good Grief?
www.good-grief.org. And we're also on Facebook, and we have a good time on social media.
Well, it sounds like you actually have a good time at changing the way maybe some bad times rolled out or the outcome of them. So I appreciate your effort, and you're doing a great thing, my friend. Obviously, you have a long history, and people can go onto your website and read your bio, very admirable work that you're doing.
Well, thanks very much, and I really appreciate the invite, and hope this conversation was helpful to folks listening.
So, absolutely.
Thanks
absolutely.
Very much,
be good,
Mark.
Joe.
All right. Be well.
You too. Now, cheers. In the beginning of the show, we were talking about Chris Martin's show last night in New York City, a very small, intimate, undisclosed location until yesterday afternoon, and we played a clip for you. I want to tell you a little bit more how that rolled out. So in the afternoon, we found out, my wife and I, we had to meet at a hotel off of Houston Street, and Houston Street is in the downtown area in New York City. on the east side, this particular hotel. We met there, and then we were told very quickly to go two doors down to a movie theater where we thought the show was going to be played, Chris Martin, live acoustically. And we get there and wait an hour or so, and we're told to go somewhere else. And we'll continue the story right after this. But here's a clip of Chris on stage. And this is all taken with my iPhone, so please forgive the audio quality. But still, at least I'm allowed to bring some of the relive the night for your sake and for my sake, because I had a great time as well. And it's pretty neat. He talks about, he goes into a song, Paradise, which, you know, everyone pretty much knows. Paradise. That's as far as I go. And he starts out playing the wrong song. Here it is on PRN.
Okay. I feel a little bit lonely without the rest of our band, so be extra nice if you would.
Thank you.
You've been very friendly, I've got to say. Okay, this is called Paradise. Yeah. That's not paradise, that's something shitty.
You're listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Guy McPherson. Join me and Mike Sleva with Nature Bats Last Radio on PRN.FM. Catch us Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. on the East Coast. You can rate the show on iTunes, and if you don't catch us live, you can catch us 24/7 in the PRN archives. That's 8 p.m. Eastern Time with Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM.
This is Peter Roth, host of Energy Stew, Friday mornings at 11:30 Eastern Time. For our society to make progress, it's important to see how we're influenced to make wrong decisions. This week I'm interviewing Robert Ferguson, a law professor and author of Inferno, An Anatomy of American Punishment, to understand how our prisons and justice system are so out of control. Tune in to learn how it got that way and how we can change it on Energy Stew, Friday morning at 11:30.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, host of the Alternative Vision Show on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Join me this coming Saturday, August 9th at 1 p.m., when I'll dissect the latest U.S. GDP reports. Last week, the show was postponed due to a technical glitch, but we'll look at in depth this coming Saturday at whether the U.S. GDP and economy really grew by 4% in the second quarter after a 2.9% drop in the first quarter. Is the U.S. economy really that volatile? What's going on? Join me on the Alternative Vision Show this Saturday at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
PRN would like to thank its listeners for making us number one on Zeno Radio's phone service and also the top searched internet radio station on Google. Thank you for helping us move forward.
That's front man Chris Martin. That was live last night at a private location. And we were talking about this all morning for the last hour. Basically, this is how it unfolded. People won tickets in the tri-state area to see Coldplay, just Chris Martin, acoustic, live, but they weren't told where. Sort of when. They told you when the day was. They told you yesterday, the 6th of August, but you had no more information until a certain time. And to backtrack a little bit, we had to meet at a hotel. Met at a hotel. Then we were told to go two doors down to a movie theater where we met. And then we were brought to a small club a few blocks away off of Houston. There we stood for about 90 minutes outside. Very happy about that. The door is open. We go inside. And there I went. my wife and I about 15 feet away from the stage. It was amazing. Very, very powerful. I mean, he's a great guy. He's so affable, genuine, natural. You know, he's just a consummate performer. It just connects like that with the audience. And that was Stars, a clip of the song that's on his latest CD. And he did many, many hits. And it was very, very interesting. You know, people really got a good kick out of it. And the clip I played right into our commercials a few moments ago, he started to play the song Paradise. And he was totally playing some other song, because in the first 5-10 seconds, I'm like, whoa, maybe I'm a little off here, but that doesn't sound like Paradise. And he stops. He goes, hey, that's not Paradise. That's some shit song. He actually went on to say, you know, that's some shit song I wrote that was never intended for anyone to hear, especially be on an album, nor sure should anyone have heard that live. So he was actually very humorous, as usual, and jocular and very interactive with the crowd. And I'll tell you a little bit more about what happened at the conclusion of the show, which lasted about 60 minutes. And I think there wasn't a disappointed fan in the house, for sure. Well, earlier this week, you heard about the passing of James Brady, the former White House press secretary under Reagan, who was in the line of fire back in 1981 when Ronald Reagan had an assassination attempt on his life by John Hinckley Jr. Man, I haven't heard that name in a while. And he was in a chair for the remainder of his life after that traumatic brain injury. And he was a staunch, major, major advocate for gun control. And I want to share a story with you, because I've read so many good things about him throughout the years, besides his tireless efforts. But he was just a great guy, just really warm-hearted, genuine, and always, you know, out to do what every public servant should do, serve the people, even though he wasn't in a public role. So my sister Mary most of my family does some work with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention due to my brother's suicide. And so she met him, this is probably back in pre-2000. They were in a hotel in New York City for an AFSP gala. And she's waiting outside an elevator. The elevator door is open. Guess who comes rolling out? James Brady. He was being honored that night by AFSP for all his work with the gun control. And I believe he's doing some work with mental health as well. That's why he's being honored. So my sister had a great conversation with him. And I spoke to her the other day. And, you know, she couldn't remember all the exact points. But the resounding message was how nice he was, how interested he was in learning about her, what her mission was, why she was there. Did she lose somebody? Was she a friend, or was she married to someone who took their life? So right then and there, that tells you what a great guy he was. That here he is being honored at a gala in New York City, probably had many, many important people to talk to. And he was interested to find out what this stranger had to say. And was a great listener, because you could be someone, you know, like the Bill Clinton, the Clinton-esque factor, the Clinton factor. Like, you know, when you talk to the Clintons, Bill Clinton in particular, you've heard this, certainly you've read about it, how he makes you feel like there's no one else in the world. Certainly at that moment that matters. So the same thing with James Brady. My sister said that she just felt like he was so in tune and interested in my words and my story, that she just walked away with a great, great feeling of who he is and what he's done. I mean, the Brady Bill that Clinton signed back in, I think that was 93, that was made into law, about the 5-day waiting period for a background check when you purchase a handgun. So that was a pivotal thing for, you know, major gun control. And that was a major step back in 1993. And obviously in the last 4, 5, 6 years, we realize we have a long way to go for gun control. But I just wanted to take a moment to reflect on James Brady, because, you know, there was a lot in the press and certainly on TV about him and what a great guy he was. And just want to share you that intimate story there. So unfortunately, summer's here, man, and it looks like it's about to slip away. I always say, man, once the 4th of July is here, forget it. August is here. It's almost like, you know, start packing up the beach stuff and put it away, because September is right around the corner. So it made me think about summer jobs and kids nowadays and what they do or don't do, and all the things I did. And I think as a kid in the summertime, that it really helped define me, because I hated, like most kids, I hated and still hate as an adult to be bored. So, of course, like every other child, pretty much then, back then, I don't know about nowadays, I was a paper boy. And I also got a job at a garage, a mechanic shop. I swept the garage, I think, 2 or 3 days a week for like maybe 2 hours a clip. Taught some, taught some basic mechanics on cars. I worked at a store called Hubbard's Cupboard. Hubbard's Cupboard was like a Quick Check, 7-Eleven, Wawa, depending on where you live, or internationally. It's a convenience store. I stood in the back and looked at Playboys. Well, that's when I wasn't, you know, working to register, and then I would be looking at Playboys again. Well, actually, it's a funny story. Back then, I actually got someone fired because I was probably about 14 then, 13 or 14, working to register. Not legally, because there was this guy who worked there named Skip. Skip was paid to work to register. Skip would say, "Hey, Mark, I'll teach you how to work to register." And I loved it. Here I am, a 13-year-old guy, you know, working to register. I loved it. So he'd go in the back, whatever, his girlfriend would come over and have some fun. And I guess they had a camera back then, and they saw that he wasn't doing his job. That wasn't my fault he got fired. But anyway, and then I back in college, I was a landscaper, learned a lot of pivotal skills. I always wanted to be a garbage man. I have no idea why I wanted to be a garbage man, but I did. And they would not allow me. They would not give me a job. This local Freehold Cartage in Freehold, New Jersey. I went to this owner like 2 or 3 times, and he said, "Well, you'll never be able to keep up with these guys." I said, "What, are you kidding me? I'm a hard worker." And I did for about 2 weeks, and I was substantially underpaid. I think like half of what everyone else was working, the working rate was. So after I proved myself for about 2 weeks, I went up to him and said, "Hey, listen, you know, I'm doing great. We're the fastest team out there. You didn't think I was going to survive. You know, we're not only were they the fastest, they're still the fastest and maybe a little bit faster. You know, you got to pay me a little bit more money. This is hard work." He's like, "No, that's it. You're a college kid. This is all I'm going to pay you." So the first day it actually rained, when I was on a route, you actually stand in a hopper. The hopper is the back of the garbage truck where the garbage goes in. So when you're riding down the road, if you're on the side of the truck, you get pelted with rain. It actually feels like a BB gun being shot at you. So you have to kind of stand in a hopper. It was that moment. Right then and there, I said to myself, "This is garbage. This is complete BS. There's no way I am going to continue doing this job for this amount of money." So I gave that up. I was also a mover. I worked for Beacon's Moving Company. Worked in restaurants. Became a bartender, a bar back. Worked my way up in college. And then when I graduated college, I had an internship in radio, which was my first mistake. Wink, wink. But then I applied to work at Club Med. Not too many people know this about me, but I worked at Club Med, and I went to my radio station at the time and said, "Hey, listen, if I take a leave of absence, whatever I called it back then, for 6 months and go work at Club Med for the job of a lifetime, could I still have my part-time job when I come back?" They said, "Absolutely. We'd love for you to come back." So I went to Club Med, Turks and Caicos, as a bartender, hence my propensity and love for alcohol. And that's why I got into more trouble and further trouble in college, after college, up to my late 30s. Anyway, so I had time of my life in Turks and Caicos, in a Bermuda island of chain of islands right there. Beautiful, beautiful island. But it was a hard job. I got paid like pittance. Worked 7 days a week, worked 12, 14 hours a day. And in the beginning, first 2, 3, 4, 5 days, you know, I was really into fitness. I was training back then, I was doing triathlons and still recently to this day. So I would have minimal sleep, drink a lot, and work out. After 2 weeks, I was losing my tan, working out less and less because I was burning the candle at both ends, you know. Get off at 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning. You have to hang out with the beautiful guests. I mean, you know, what kind of employee of Club Med would I have been if I disappointed the guests? Next thing you know, it's 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. You got to get up and start the cycle all over again. So after a couple months, your stints should be 6 months. So after a couple months, I was totally getting burned out. And I actually got fired, believe it or not. I got fired, and I knew what I was getting into because the guy who was the manager of the bar back then was a horrible human being. And I knew this going into it. Believe it or not, I actually knew somebody who went the Club Med route before I did. And he actually went the same. I ended up going the same path he did. And I knew what I was getting myself into working for this guy. So anyway, I got fired like on a Tuesday and there was only one plane a week. It was going to be on Saturday. So they told me I had to go stay at a hotel. I'm like, well, whoa, I'm not going to go stay at a hotel. I'm going to blow all the money that I saved. So I said, let me do something else. I'll work on the snorkeling boat. So here I am, a guy who's visually impaired, working on a snorkeling boat with a guy who was I quickly befriended. And one night we were so inebriated, the next morning he could not get up and join me on a snorkeling boat. We're both so hungover. He stayed behind. I'm on a snorkeling boat. The visually impaired guy, I have to count bodies every time they jump into the water. There's 20, 30 people, and I'm saying to the captain, hey, captain, you got to help me out here. I can't see these people. Help me count them. Help me count them. And then one point, very quickly, our anchor got stuck in a rock the first day. I'm there. He goes, Mark, you got to go down there. He's French. Mark, you got to go down to the anchor, pull it up. When you hear the horn beep once, you got to move out of the way because the anchor's going to go pulling out of the water. So here I am going, are you shitting me? Maybe I should have spent all my money and stayed in a hotel. So anyway, I used the chain of the anchor to pull myself all the way down there. First time I get like halfway down, I run out of breath and I'm scared. I'm nervous. The whole boat's like leaning over, looking at me. Come back up. Try it again. Go back down. I actually get my hands on the anchor. I hear the horn. Believe it or not, I can hear the horn. Womp, womp. And I said, oh shit, I got to move out of the way. And next thing you know, the anchor goes whoosh, flying to the surface. And so that was the end of my Club Med experience. It was a great time. I did it for, 2-3 months. There's no way I would have been able to stay there for 6 months. I certainly would have been an AA to this day if I did. It was a great experience. And when I have my grandchildren sitting on my lap in a couple years, that I can reflect on those many, 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 many colorful stories. This has been Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. If you ever want to check out this show or any past shows, go on prn.fm. Check out Insight, the show. And if you'd like to have me speak at your college, professional institution, corporation, etc., check out markfarrellmotivation.com. That's M-A-R-K, F as in Frank, A-R-R-E-L-L, motivation.com. Next week, looking forward to talking to you again. Thursdays right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great Thursday, Friday, and weekend. Talk to you next week. Paradise, 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 paradise. And that is the outro, the last song he played last night. How could I be remiss in saying, this is Chris Martin of Coldplay in his private show for 200 people last night, where my wife got to shake his hand when he was making his way off stage. We're going to close with the rest of Paradise on PRN.FM. Enjoy. Bullets catching a team. Life goes on, it gets so heavy. The wheel breaks a butterfly. Every tear a waterfall.